Hello everyone, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. And if this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to Season 7 of our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode will be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We'll talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And as always, we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to an archive disruptor and changemaker who goes by the name Archival Decolonist. Nathan Mudgee Sentence is a Wiradjuri librarian and museum educator who grew up on Darkindjung country in New South Wales. Nathan works to ensure that First Nations stories held within the GLAM sector, that is galleries, libraries, archives and museums, are being told and controlled by First Nations people. Nathan has worked with the State Library of New South Wales and the Australian Museum, and is a founding member of the Indigenous Archives Collective. At present, he works at the Powerhouse in Sydney, where his title is Head of Collections First Nations. He also writes about critical librarianship and critical museology from a First Nations perspective. And his words can be found in The Guardian, Cordite Poetry, The Lifted Brow, The Sydney Review of Books, and on his own blog, The Archival Decolonist. Nathan, welcome to Archive Fever.
Yeah, here am I. Thanks for having me.
Nathan, to begin, I'm curious about your journey to becoming the archival decolonist. How did the child version of Nathan grow up into someone who goes into colonial institutions to make them better? Was there a kind of particular moment or encounter in your formative years that gave you your own personal archive fever?
Not really. Besides learning to love to read from the local library, like my dad would bring me there and I just remember they had Where the Wild Things Are toys and that got me into reading. Besides that, I'm interested in stories and I'm definitely more when I got to about being a teenager, a few formative sort of things happened that I saw that there was a discrepancy between what my family was saying and what was happening, I guess, in like the broader discussion, whether it be at school or in the media. So like tragically TJ Hickey's death in Redfern, which led to sort of the Redfern sort of like rebellions, other people call them riots. And then I guess the Cronulla riots. I just remember being 16 and having all this sort of like vitriol being said all around me at school, seeing the violence happen and then seeing the same media that was sort of riling up people to like go do something, step away and go, oh, tis, 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 like. And yeah, and then I guess in school, just like reading things like Cook Discovered Australia, things like that, when I was just like, well, that's not what Dad says. And it was just like, I guess like, you know, that discrepancy. And then I really got very lucky. I got to work at the Darkindjung Local Aboriginal Land Council and sort of work in cultural heritage from a very particular angle. But that gave me some skills that I was able to, lucky enough, get a cadetship at the State Library of New South Wales under sort of the mentorship of Ronald Briggs and Melissa Jackson, who have been Indigenous librarians there since 1991 and have been sort of foundational and sort of like, I guess, like Aboriginal library practice with several other really important figures, but creating things like the Atzilin protocols and things of that nature. Yeah, I sort of had a curiosity about collections, but I actually didn't think about the potential damage that they could cause or the potential erasures that they have. One of my early days at the State Library was community groups would come to the State Library to look at records about themselves. And I remember one particular time where we had these missionaries' diaries. So like a lot of the stolen generation information is actually with Aboriginal affairs and state records, but personal records or like things that don't fall under like state records, a lot of that went to like the State Library of New South Wales. And yeah, so we had personal missionary diaries, for example, of the missions that were carrying out the stolen generations. And I remember an auntie reading a record about herself and her saying something along the lines of, like, she was reading and she got really excited because she's like, oh, that's me. But the record said, I think it was like she needed additional care because she broke her arm. And she was like, you know, I've never broken my arm in my life. I would get an x-ray today to prove it. And it was just one of those things early on in my library career that I was like, well, Arnie's lived experience and this written record, there's a clash here that's potentially, you know, like comparably to other aspects of the records is like innocuous, saying that she broke her arm. But it did solidify for me that this missionary's diary was in this repository of New South Wales / Australian history and Arnie's lived experience wasn't. And I just know that, like, you know, that, you know, you'd see, like, what's his name? Thomas Keneally comes into the State Library to write books and stuff like that. And lots of people do. And that's what they would use as the record. And I was thinking, they're not actually getting sort of this full picture. And I guess that's what sort of led me to think, whose voices are missing from these collections and whose voices get privileged and how do we collect things and why do we collect things? And I guess that's just continued on to museums, which have a very similar vibe, like, you know, the Australian Museum, while it didn't have so much like written records, you can see the sort of, I guess, the colonial perspective in how things were collected. When I used to work at the Australian Museum, it was like 90% cultural objects that related to men. And we were just thinking that there was probably many reasons for that, but just straight up bias. Like a lot of the anthropologists in the early expeditions were men, so they were just collecting men's objects. Also too, sometimes we think it's also cultural protocols, like if there were communities that were actually working with the anthropologists, they probably would only share knowledge that was men-related. But we potentially, again, also bias in what they thought about Aboriginal people. So they almost collected things to confirm their biases. Like, so a lot of the men's objects that we have is considered weaponry. And they're probably just like, well, Aboriginal people are savage or wear something else. So they're just like, let's collect shields and spears, and that's their culture, so it confirms what we already think about them. So, yeah, and I guess those sort of things is why I sort of, I'm not sure if interest is the right word, but like why I work, I guess, in the space to sort of hopefully do a little bit to make it a little bit different. Yeah.
It's a different kind of closing the gap, isn't it, that you're describing? It's closing the gap between your truth, your lived experience, the stories that you've been told and what you know. This is what you're describing as a teenager, to go back to that. And then what is on the written record or the media portrayal. It just struck me listening to you speak that it's a different kind of closing the gap measure that we don't have a measurement for, in a sense. We only have the experience of and the work that people like you are doing.
Yeah, I guess it is. And I think it's a sort of question that I don't think people ask a lot, is like, whose voice is missing, or like how much is missing by, or, you know, there were a couple of examples that have happened where I can actually quantify the gaps to a certain extent. Like when I was at the State Library, we did this project called Rediscovering Indigenous Languages. We hired a linguist to identify language lists in our manuscripts collection, and then we digitized them, and then we tried to do outreach to give them back to community. And in that, we identified about 200 objects, which some are like, you know, boxes and boxes of papers, and one might be just one note in a missionary's diary, but there was lots of material. But out of, I think it was like 200 or so objects, only one was written by an Indigenous person. It was like Mary Jane Kane was the only language list that was written by an Indigenous person. And then that straight away also led to that sort of misrepresentation too, really just because of the biases. As I was saying about how people would write language, like I heard Uncle Lloyd Doylan talk about this with, I guess, like the Wiradjuri language. And he was saying that with a lot of Wiradjuri dictionaries that missionaries wrote and stuff like that, they would use the term D, which is sort of like D-H-I. And it's usually referred to my. So you'd say like table D, it would be my table. But he was reckoning that basically saying the D is more like I have responsibility to it. The reason why we think of it that way now is because of actually the miscommunication between colonists and Wiradjuri people. And the D is more like, I have responsibility to it, or it comes from me. And I guess that's just the sort of thing where you're coming from a different worldview and trying to transcribe a language, that's what could happen.
That's an epistemology gap.
And I guess that's happened. And then also too, at my new job at the powerhouse, I was very lucky that they, because I had to move a lot of the collection, they had to make sure that to sort of digitize it and audit it. And so by the time I started, I actually basically knew how much Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultural material was in the collection. And they said about 6,000 objects. And then when I got there, we sort of looked at them. And there are 6,000 objects that probably contain cultural relevancy or cultural meaning. But there's only about, when I started, about 1,200 objects that were actually made by the hearts, hands, and minds of Aboriginal people. A lot of it was like photography taken by non-Indigenous people for like postcards and things like that. Or like the history of design, which like... For even in times of like, I guess, like extreme segregation, a lot of Aboriginal designs would make their way onto things that were identifying to Australia. So like mob on tea sets and boomerangs and lots of things. So we take care of them because they need sort of that care and sort of interpretation. But yeah, they're not really made by mob in the first place. So yeah, if the powerhouse collection is 500,000 objects, it works out to be about 0.03% of the collection is made by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And you can think about all the histories of the powerhouses. They've got really cool histories. You know, a lot of stuff about agriculture, a lot of stuff about transport, especially of New South Wales. And a lot of Aboriginal people worked in those industries, but those stories haven't been sort of captured into the powerhouse collection. So I guess that's what we're trying to do now. But I guess these are the times where I've actually been able to quantify that gap. Yeah.
And I'm interested in, I guess, what that feels like for you as someone working in these spaces. On this podcast, you know, we often ask our guests the question, you know, what does archive fever feel like for you? And people often talk about it, you know, in sort of generally positive terms as being this kind of addictive rush and kind of gambling type experience. But I'm really conscious that the way you've kind of described your work in these colonial institutions sounds like, you know, being on enemy territory in a way, on sites of erasure and violence and trauma. What does that mean for you working in these spaces day to day? Like, do you enjoy being in these spaces, or does it feel like a space you kind of need to brace yourself to go into?
Oh, yeah. That's a good question. It's kind of both. One of the things I do when community come visit the collections, I usually give them a warning and basically say, you know, these collections can cause a lot of emotions. It can be grief or it can be anger, but it can be joy. Sometimes reconnecting with words that you haven't seen before, that you know that was spoken by your ancestors, is a joyous thing. But sometimes it can be a sad thing too, because you know those words might have been taken away from the generation between you and your ancestor because of the colonial imposition. They've been taken away from you. So I guess, yeah, you sort of have to brace yourself a little bit, I guess, to enter these spaces and these institutions. But, you know, it's a privilege as well, I find. I think it's in the little ways that you can, being able to bring things to the surface, being able to assist in other people telling sort of, you know, important truths and talking about their lived experiences is a big joy. But I guess it's one of those things where you sometimes enter the, like, I remember when I went for my job interview at the State Library, I almost felt like I wasn't allowed in there. I was like old sandstone and it feels imposing and you're just like, oh, I don't know if this is the right place. And I never really like thought about it like theoretically or anything like that. But like, I think I just came to expect places like that to just be bad or like just have pictures of old, bald white dudes that have important jobs throughout the history, and they would always say, you know, the first doctor in town or something like that, you know, all having sort of like a start point that erases all this history before it and all the history afterwards too. Like, I think living in Sydney, that's one of the things, and I think it probably happens in a lot of metropolitan areas, but like when you talk to tourists or even talk to like Australians, they'll talk about Aboriginal culture as being elsewhere as well. Like they'll often say, you know, oh, I need to go out there to experience it, rather than realizing that these sites that have been built upon are still Aboriginal land and still have lots of Aboriginal culture. That's sort of the Paul Irish book, Hidden in Plain View, sort of, yeah.
I want to ask you about this word and concept, decolonization, in relation to colonial institutions. You have this great blog called The Archival Decolonist, but in an interview from a few years ago, you said you were sort of developing some misgivings about that language, sort of wondering, you know, to what extent can colonial institutions ever be decolonized? What are you thinking about the concept of decolonization these days?
Yeah, I think I just saw that in an article once, the archival decolonist, I think Taylor Genevieve was for Alternative, the Indigenous Studies journal. I just sort of joked and said that I would like that to be my career. I would love to be the archival decolonist. So then I sort of named my blog that. I guess it just, with time, like that sort of optimism sort of died down. I went through a period of, and it probably happens, you know, generationally as well. Like you see things like this, for lack of a better term, trends. So of course, the term decolonization's been around since like the late 1800s or something like that. But I felt like I want to change. I want to decolonize this place. And then I started seeing the terminology be adopted and I guess sanitized. And then people were just using it for everything. Like they were just saying like, oh, let's, you know, decolonize tennis or, you know, things of that nature. I was a librarian and then later started reading more theory and stuff like that. I came to decolonization is not a metaphor by Tuck and Yang a lot later than a lot of other people. And I read it and I was like, yeah, that's right. Like we're using decolonization as a sort of metaphor, but it's not actually shifting the end goal, I guess, of land back or even to a certain extent, like disrupting, I guess, power imbalances. Because I would just see that people would say, oh, you know, we're decolonizing the library and all they would do is put an Aboriginal flag in the library, which again, I don't want to criticize that. I think that's it's a good starting point, but it's not really shifting power or that of radical movement. So I guess that's where my personal sort of like disenfranchisement, I guess, to decolonization came. And then I've sort of flipped and sort of gone back to it a little bit. Well, not so much, but I think what's happened is I've seen other terminology being used instead of decolonizing. And I think I understand where some mob are coming from because a lot of mob will say they're not interested in decolonizing because these are innately colonial institutions. So it's impossible. They've, colonization is their bones. They were formed from colonization. They can't be decolonized. So all we can do is indigenize them. We can just bring Indigenous perspectives in them and change them through Indigenous epistemologies. But as I see that start to be adopted, I fear it has that sort of same flattening or sanitization that will happen that will just lead to mob being disenfranchised again. And I guess always trying to find that, I guess, terminology to explain what we want to do, which is, I guess, yeah, figuring out how to disrupt the colonialism of these collecting organizations or broader structures that still oppress. And then figuring out how to sort of, I guess, dream up new ones and to make sure that Indigenous epistemologies are the things that help dream them up, that help create them, that and also too that we can think of just, I guess, think of the things that we do as radically different, like preservation, history telling, access, what a collection is, I think.
And so is part of that reconciling that disjuncture between theory and practice, the more academic theory of decolonization and the practice of actually working in museums and archives and libraries, is part of that finding new ways of doing things, partly not about what already exists in the collection, but about accessioning new items, bringing new things into the collections that are not already there. You've given us that stark statistic about the powerhouses collection. And I imagine out of that 0.003 that you said, many of those items are the spears and shields type of material objects. So do you actively collect new items that are going to be able to tell new stories and open up new truths?
100%. And yeah, that's actually one of the big things that we're doing at the moment. But also too, just like trying to figure out a different ways of doing it. So like one of the things I'm the beneficiary of before I started at the Powerhouse, Terry Jenke and company and Uncle Marcus Hughes, who worked at the Powerhouse for quite a while, developed these ICIP policies. They developed them. We get the opportunity of putting them into practice.
Can you spell that acronym out for us?
Oh yeah. Indigenous Cultural Intellectual Property. You know, museums, we just like acronyms. And one of the things we've done with that is further develop the deed deposit, which Terry Jenke and co and Marcus made, which was a way for community to deposit cultural belongings into the collection, but not transfer legal ownership. So we've done it with Aunty Gail Mabo, has given two of her dad's shirts, Eddie Kwoki Mabo's So they're in the Powerhouse collection. We could potentially care for them in perpetuity, but they're legally hers. So if any time she wants, she's allowed to take them back. And I like it because that's a sort of a system of, I guess, creating accountability for us. Like if she doesn't like what we're doing, she's a legal owner, she can take them back. But also to ensure that we keep serving community's needs, because at the moment, what community needs from us is us to preserve those shirts and use our really skilled conservators to know how to, you know, treat fabric and such and air conditioning storage and all that. But maybe in 30 years, they'll build a Marlboro museum and the shirts might be better preserved or better served there. So we can ensure that happens because we don't actually have to repatriate them. They're just, they belong to her. And also too, we sort of did that to, with the idea that it would also build trust with community, because so much of times, I guess it's been that sort of extractive process of even the Powerhouse, which is not really like an anthropology museum, but you talk to a mob about museums and they immediately go thinking about stolen objects and objects taken far away from home without any sort of free and prior informed consent. So we don't actually have much of that, but that's still what mob think about when they think of a museum. So the deed is also one of those ways of trying to get mob to, I guess, trust museums. And also too, trying to figure out ways of doing other things like, I guess, like intangible heritage, because sometimes mob want to record their stories, not in sort of like, I guess, like a real physical form, but maybe like oral histories and things of that nature. It might be things we need to collect. And also one of the things we're trying to do is invite, I guess, a writer reply to our collection. As I was saying, there's lots of gaps that need to be filled, but also to like, I guess, misrepresentations as well as that. And one of the things we're trying to do is invite mob the opportunity to respond to it. And that's not my concept. That's like the Indigenous Archives Collective sort of came up with the right of reply to archives based on that like journalistic premise of like, if you're going to write about someone ethically, you should give them a chance to respond. And we believe that, you know, a lot of mob have been written about in archives. Ethically, they should have the chance to respond. But in a practical sense, we wanted to try and do that at the Powerhouse. And initially, we were thinking that would be more in the, I guess, the collection record. We give mob the chance to respond within the collection record and add their own interpretation to objects previously about them. But we found that, not in all cases, but a lot of mob, that wasn't that interesting to them. They actually would like to do some sort of a different response. Like they would actually like to do something a bit more creative, you know, working with one particular community that we wanted them to sort of write about these old photographs from the 1800s. And they said that wasn't very interesting to them. And actually what they would like to do would actually take new photographs today and actually have them live in conversation with those older photographs.
That's the pesky part of giving people the right of the reply. Yeah. They don't always say what you want them to.
No, which is good, but it was a learning curve because that was where I was like, because I was like, I guess like the interpretation or the record that lives with a collection object is the collection object's truth. That's the place where mob could make some change. And we've done some things like, you know, adding small things like dual naming of objects that previously have been given, just sort of like shield or spear, things like that, getting the language in there as well.
Nathan, you just said this model of the right of reply was developed by the Indigenous Archives Collective. Tell us more about that collective. Who are you? What are you doing? What are your objectives?
So yeah, we're a collective of archivists nationally and internationally. We have mob from Aotearoa and North America. It was founded by Dr. Kirsten Thorpe and Dr. Shannon Forkhead. It was originally like the Indigenous Archives Network, and they sort of created that in, I think it was like 2011. But with support of like UTS and a few others, there's been a push a few years ago to revitalize it, and we became a collective. And so we're Indigenous archivists or people who work in archives and collections, and also allies that sort of are working on the same thing. And it was, I guess it's a space for us to do lots of things, like we do sort of advocacy work. A lot of the members put together the writer reply statement, and that was sort of just a push out to GLAM organizations. But we're also a group, I guess, to nourish each other. So like it's a group where we can come together and sort of talk about what we're seeing as, I guess, like issues in these spaces, or figuring out ways we can support one another and what we do. And also a space, I think, for some mob not to make them feel not lonely, I guess, because I'm very lucky. I'm part of a team at the Powerhouse, and I was part of a team everywhere I've been. I think I would have burnt out too quickly if I wasn't, but there are a lot of mob who are not part of teams. They're the one sole Aboriginal employee within an organisation, and there's that sort of big sort of colonial load on them for the work. I remember when one of the nicest emails I got about my blog when I started it was another curator who basically said they really enjoyed the blog, mostly because it made them feel not so like it was all in their head, because they had no one to sort of bounce what was happening to them in the cultural organization. And they were just like, what you said really is the same stuff that I've been thinking. And now I have some confirmation that it is important, and with colleagues that don't quite see what you're seeing. I wouldn't say it's a like forceful like gaslighting, but it's almost like, yeah, just like, yeah, no, that's not a really big deal. Or like, you know.
Yeah, just the lack of validation is another form of colonial violence.
Yeah. I think it is important to have sort of the spaces where we can sort of just get together and yarn and just sort of say, this is what's happening. Yeah.
I want to go into your writing, because as well as sort of working in museums, you're a really beautiful essayist and poet in kind of evoking the violence and the meaning of these colonial memory spaces. I first encountered your work, Nathan, through a really wonderful review essay you wrote in the Sydney Review of Books, reviewing Natalie Harkin's archival poetics. And of course, we've also had Natalie Harkin on the podcast. And I just want to quote a little lines from there that really stuck with me. You wrote, "Archives are unreliable witnesses, especially here on these lands of invasion and occupation. As a collection of fragments of what actually happened, the archives of settler colonialism are full of misremembered histories, partial truths, and falsifications. They are also propaganda machines for the settler fantasy, selling a narrative of the state saving and civilizing us as First Nations people." I love the way you use metaphor so effectively in this piece. You know, these phrases, unreliable witnesses, propaganda machines. And it got me thinking about the way so many First Nations people are using poetry and poetic imagery to speak back to colonial archives. You know, there's Natalie Harkin, Jasmine, Tony Birch, so many others. Why do you think there is this kind of turn to poetry as a way to speak back to the archive? What does poetry offer you?
I can only speak from my experience, but like, I guess there is also a desire to disrupt English to a certain extent. Like with poetry, I guess it's a play with words. So you can sort of make your own rules within poetry, I guess, make visible colonial structures, but at the same time, like undermine them a little bit. I guess it's like a tool for that. I guess also too, like I think art and imagination are just great disruptors. And I guess poetry also allows a space for that. In terms of like, I get, I forgot his name, Hawaiian scholar. He does the five stages of colonization and the five stages of decolonization. And one of the first stages of decolonization is basically dreaming, like dreaming up a new world. And I guess poetry is an avenue for that. And as I was saying with the writer reply, I think a lot of First Nations people want to respond to these records creatively. And I guess that's also like almost a rejection off the systems that have captured this knowledge in the first place. It's almost to sort of reject it and free it is to do it in your own way. And I think that extends, yeah, like incredible work by like Jasmine, Natalie Harkin, but, you know, other artists like Tony Albert, Carla Dickens, they're all sort of playing with these colonial narratives that have existed for a long time and repurposing them and disrupting them and playing with them and adding humor and things of that nature, which I think, again, undermine them, take their power away a little bit. Yeah.
Nathan, if you had not just story, poetry, words at your disposal, but a big bucket of money and power. So, for example, you were appointed by the federal government to revolutionize our national cultural institutions, what would be your key recommendations? How would you build
something that was more fit for purpose for our modern nation?
Yeah, I think, well, firstly, I think I would try to empower local Aboriginal keeping places around Australia. So I think that would be one thing, is because they're places they have where community on the ground can tell their own stories from their own perspectives and also be very locally connected, I guess, to the local history. And I feel like they can be able to sort of tell all these different stories and be places of, I guess, cultural revitalization and cultural strengthening. I'd empower, like, as much as I could, the local cultural centres first. And I think I would, with the bigger museums, I think if you asked me like 10 years ago, I would have been like, get rid of them.
Burn them down.
Yeah, I think that would have been my vibe. And some days that's still my vibe. But I think that in seeing some of the things that happen around the world, you kind of worry about like the complete destruction of like institutions that, well, some institutions that are basically free to the public and inspire knowledge. But I think there would be a thing where if you had the time and the money, would be like, if this museum was made with First Nations people at the start of the sort of how we work, and also thinking about working with country, and also thinking about what do humans need, I guess, is like one of those things, like we need knowledge, creativity, we need a planet that keeps living. Like, it's important to preserve things for future generations. What about people living now? What can we do to sort of enact that? And I think that would be a thing too, would be just changing ideas around preservation and stories and thinking about how stories can live now and shift and change. And I guess like my thinking around that is like, I guess like Aboriginal sacred sites and stuff like that. I always believe that one of museums' missions is to preserve knowledge for future generations. I reckon that should include advocacy for things like Aboriginal sacred sites. As museums, we should be advocating for their protection. And often it'd be like not considered the museum's purview unless we took that sacred tree and put it in the collection, which decontextualizes it. And then it actually is not useful for that knowledge passing down. And I guess, I think it was that, it's Victor Stevenson in that book, Fire Country, where he was talking about knowledge in a database is good, but it's better in people. And I think for a lot of First Nations people, I guess that's it. I guess knowledge without action is sort of, it's empty to a certain extent. So it should be a living knowledge that's embodied. So we should figure out how to sort of do that more and try to, I'm not sure if I'm making sense.
No, it's a really interesting point. And it's, as you're speaking, it's making me think about how the whole Western model of a museum is based on this kind of paradigm of taking things and hoarding them and decontextualizing them. And that in many ways that just seems kind of fundamentally counter to First Nations ways of seeing knowledge and heritage and ideas as deeply embedded in place and relationships. And yeah, so I love this idea of yours of, you know, bringing sacred sites into the purview of museums and kind of expanding the idea of where the museum is and what it should care about.
And those local keeping places that are on country that you suggest might be part of the answer to this and become very much vital parts of communities. Are there examples around Australia or globally where that is already happening so that could provide some model for the big national cultural institutions and state cultural institutions to learn best practice from?
I don't know the names off the top of my head, but there's definitely some in Canada, like First Nations people of Canada have been creating one. But there's also really good examples. I think Northern Territory has had years to sort of develop, I guess, like the art center model. One of the cool things about that is the really ethically run mob get to create their art, sell their art, pass down their stories, but also be economically viable. And I remember talking to a fellow who ran one, and he was saying when he was developing it, I won't name the town, but a small town in Northern Territory was very unhappy about the establishment of this. You know, a lot of racism in the town. And then they all turned around when they started developing, because it was actually one of the only reasons why tourists would come to the town. So they were all making money from this sort of thing. But yeah, I think the art centre model, like those sort of seeing them and...
And certainly somewhere like Bukulange Morka in Yirrkala has provided that sort of focus point for the community, great cultural production, but also now archival holdings like the Morka Centre there.
Yeah, and some of them have created their own, even like libraries where they've created, I forgot what the library is, but they actually created their own organizational system based on their own knowledges rather than use the Dewey Decibel system. So there are examples out there of like, and I think, yeah, empowering them. And I guess like, it's one of those things where it's like, it's not just money, it just needs to be time as well. Cause those things take so long to sort of develop, but once they're running, I think they're super powerful. Yeah.
And funnily enough, those places I'm thinking of, Bukulange is a place I've spent quite a lot of time in. They have visitation rates and demographics, if you were going to break down the people who come to them, that the big institutions would kill for, because they got kids running around through there, they got old people in there, they got tourists coming in there. It's exciting that you suggest that as being the future, because I can see the way that that would work.
Yeah, I think they're powerful spaces, and I guess they, one of the things that I find kind of like, don't want to be hyperbolic, but like a little bit sad when because I go around regional New South Wales a lot. A lot of the regional museums are very the same, like they just have tractors in them, and you know, it's good, but they're missing a large part of their town's history. And what separates their town potentially from another town from all over the world is sort of the Aboriginal history that's in those places. And I think that should be something that could be celebrated. And I guess that's one of the things that, it's a space where community can actually strengthen culture, but be paid to, you know, to do so. I guess one of the limitations that a lot of mob have is they would love to spend all their time revitalizing language or teaching kids how to dance and things of those nature. And a lot of people do, but they have to do it around their full-time jobs or, you know, their bills and their rent and all those sort of things. So if there was economic opportunities for them to, one of my mentors, Laura McBride, who works at the Australian Museum, used to always say, like, kids get like 7 hours a day of Western education. There should be some funding for them to get cultural education at the same time.
That's a kind of Marxist principle, isn't it? But just 8 hours of work, 8 hours of play, 8 hours of rest. 7 hours of Western education, 7 hours of language education.
Nathan, unfortunately, we're going to have to start wrapping up this interview. But I am really curious to know, I guess, how the Australian glam sector is doing on these questions, kind of comparatively. A few moments ago, you mentioned examples from Canada. Obviously, the glam sector all around the world is dealing with these questions of decolonization, indigenization, justice, and ethics. Is Australia a leader in this space? Are we a laggard? Are we somewhere in the middle?
Yeah, I think it's tricky. I think we're both. I remember talking to friends, I've had yarns about the importance of, like, I guess, acknowledgement of country and stuff like that. And similar to, like, I guess, yarns of decolonization were like, has this become sanitized? And then I guess one of the things that shook me out of that was I had a Native American person visit our museum, and in our meeting we had the acknowledgement of country, and she was like, oh my God, like, that's incredible. We're fighting for some recognition of our mob in where she was from. And I was like, oh, it is actually in some places, like, it is a radical thing. And there are some things where I think, yeah, just work from, you know, so many deadly people, like Kimberly Moulton was a curator for a museum of Melbourne for a very long time. Gilda Andrews in sort of National Museum now, and all these like deadly scholars, and you know, as I say, Ronald Briggs, Melissa Jackson, these people have been working at it for a very long time and creating, yeah, really good change. And but I guess like it's good in some ways because hopefully it's just something that, like, in an international network, it's something that we can all learn from. Because I think there are practices from like Aotearoa New Zealand museums that we would love to adopt here, but then yeah, again, there's some things that we do that. Yeah, yarn to this Native American scholar, she was like, there's lots of things that we would love to do here. But I guess, like, it's not a linear ranking system, I guess. There's lots of ways we're falling short of other institutions, but there's also lots of ways where our discussions about, like, Indigenous cultural and intellectual property, I think, are probably some things that I think on an international scale, I think would yeah, I think it's one of those things where I reckon will inspire other institutions like globally.
And finally, Nathan, I'd like to ask the question we ask all our guests on Archive Fever. Do you have a dirty little archive secret you're willing to share with us?
Yeah, I should have thought about this more. I don't know, because I think I write about all my secrets. Like, I think, because I was thinking about, I guess, like guilty thoughts, and I guess my guilty thoughts are like, there are some things that are just so like racist that you're just like, I want to chuck in the bin. But I have written things where I've said that I would like to do that. Or, you know, you visualize time traveling just to like fight these people in the records because they're so horrible. I guess my dirty secret is semi-embarrassing for someone who works in archives, and I don't want it to be too much of a criticism of public education, but I'm really horrible at reading running writing, which is very important for archives. So the combination of old English, running writing, and people saving paper. So I've seen people that...
The cross-hatch. Yeah. Oh, God. No, that's a nightmare.
I am bad at it. It takes me a long time to figure out what people are saying. So I guess that's my embarrassing secret about archives.
Well, I think you'll get validation from us that sounds pretty bloody normal to me.
Yeah, it takes me a long time as well. I'm afraid that's all we have time for today, but thank you so much for joining us, Nathan. It's been wonderful to have you.
To learn more about Nathan's work, you can follow him on LinkedIn or Instagram at SayWhatNathan, or check out his blog, archivaldecolonist.org.
You can follow Claire on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
And you can follow Eve on Instagram at Eve_Rees. Don't forget that you can catch up on all of seasons 1 through 6 via the website archivefeverpod.com. And you can also listen and subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you choose to listen.
If you like what you hear, please give us a rating or review so other nerds can find us. So, until our next therapeutic session, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast. This episode was recorded at King Sound Studios on unceded Gadigal land and produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri land.
Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
Coming up on the next episode.
The Cairns Court, for some reason in the 30s, they preserved a lot of stuff, and just a human tooth just kind of fell out. Like, I picked up the file, and it was not a very clean human tooth, by the way, kind of fell out. And it was two Greek shopkeepers who'd been fighting over a debt. And one of them had punched the other, 1930s Innisfail, and he'd kept the tooth in the archive.